Watkins County.
Thank you, sir.
And I'm here on behalf of Senate Bill 305. I'm actually, more accurately, here on behalf of Josh Marquis, who is scheduled to come in this morning, but had a trial scheduled, so he can't be here.
All right.
The district attorneys, this is actually a district attorneys association bill, and simply put, it would change ORS 137225, which is commonly called the expunction statute, but that's really a misnomer because the word expunction doesn't exist anywhere in the statute. It's the statute that allows people to seal certain convictions and to act as if they had never occurred. And it also would amend the juvenile, comparable juvenile statute, which is actually is called expunction. The change is actually rather simple. The present statute, which has been amended many times over the years and is kind of a hodgepodge, allows for expunction of, or to be, certain convictions to be set aside or expunged. And those convictions are certain misdemeanors and Class C felonies. This proposed change would essentially change the focus of what can be set aside or expunged from Class C felonies to, with certain exceptions, to forbid the setting aside of Class C person felonies as defined by the sentencing guidelines rules. The reasoning of the District Attorney's Association behind this is that when this statute was originally written, it was long before sentencing guidelines came into effect, and the crimes were classified by the 1971 Criminal Code as A, B, or C felonies. And at the time that that was done, that meant a lot more than it does now. Since the passage of sentencing guidelines and some changes, I think, in our society since that time, the classification of felonies as Class A, B, or C really is not very meaningful. And it's a lot more meaningful to look at whether or not crimes are person crimes or are not person crimes. Mr. Marquis had a couple of incidents that he wanted to have me bring to your attention that had happened to him in the past in regards to the statute. Both of them happened when he was Deputy District Attorney in Deschutes County. The first incident that he wanted me to bring to your attention involved a person that he prosecuted for murder in 1993. That person had previously been convicted of assault in the third degree for stabbing the same victim approximately 5 years previously, and he had managed to get that assault conviction expunged or set aside, and so he proceeded to trial on his murder conviction as if that person had never been convicted before. Was not admissible for purposes of impeachment if the defendant testified. It also was not admissible in any consideration of sentencing. The second one that he wanted me to bring to your attention involved also was a Deschutes County case where a Washington State deputy sheriff was involved in the death of his wife, where they were climbing and she was pushed or fell and was killed. This case actually received quite a bit of publicity, and I remember reading about it in the paper myself. And the defendant had a trial to the court, and the court, after hearing the evidence, said that it was his belief that the defendant had arranged to kill his wife for financial reasons, but that he couldn't make that finding beyond a reasonable doubt, and instead found him guilty of criminally negligent homicide, which is a Class C felony, and sent him to the penitentiary. And the defendant is in the process of trying now to get that record expunged. And it's the District Attorney's Association's position that it's not appropriate under those kinds of circumstances to set those records aside. I might point out that one anomaly of the way the statutes are written that this would address is that if you kill somebody in an automobile accident and get convicted of criminally negligent homicide, you can get that set aside, but you cannot get a driving under the influence of intoxicants conviction set aside. So, does anybody have any questions with me?
I don't know that we have questions. Anybody have a question right now? Not yet. Not yet. No, I just think maybe a little background on this issue, because I guess what the bill purports to do is if a person was convicted of a Class C felony, that's classified as a person felony under the rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, they would never be able to expunge that record. Is that correct?
That's
okay. And the problem we're facing is that some persons who have had their records expunged, I'm trying to think in terms of the theory behind expungement versus a pardon.
The theory behind expungement, Mr. Chairman, is that that the legislature, when this law was created, thought that some people who are convicted of some crimes ought to be able to have a second chance. And if they keep their nose clean and do what they're supposed to do, then they can get this conviction set aside and start over again as if it never happened.
Okay, so given that, they have a second chance, and the legal effect of it is that it is as if it never occurred, correct? Do they have to
not? Well, excuse me.
That's what I'm trying to get to, the difference between a pardon and a gubernatorial pardon and an expungement. What's the legal effect of the two?
The way the statute is written, it essentially seals the records and allows the individual to answer the question under oath, if that's the situation, that no, I have never been convicted of a crime. But it does not go back and erase the conviction. It seals it and allows the person to pronounce that legal fiction. And there actually is a mechanism in the statute under limited circumstances for going back and reopening those records.
Okay. So that's why I want to get on that point, that from the theoretical perspective, what we're trying to do, or what the legislature was trying to do, is say to certain individuals that if you've been convicted of a crime, a certain period of time goes by, you've not reoffended, then this option is available to expunge the record or seal it so that you create this legal fiction wherein someone is, you know, could legally say they've never been convicted of a crime. And I assume that would apply to employment applications and these kinds of things. So, from a legislative perspective, I don't know that the legislature was intending to prevent the revelation of that information if there was a subsequent crime committed and the person was subsequently in trial as a defendant. So, I mean, I guess that's the groundwork I'd like to lay for the committee is it appropriate if an individual has been charged with a felony to prevent that information from being revealed for the purposes of impeachment notwithstanding? So, I mean, there are some ways we can look at this. If you've got a defendant who, in fact, has been convicted of a person crime that has been expunged, one alternative would be to, if that person has in fact been arrested and is at trial on a subsequent felony charge, to allow that information to be used for impeachment purposes or for sentencing. Again, the objective was to hopefully allow a person an opportunity to change their life and not be rearrested and involved in criminal activity. So anyway, lay that groundwork. And that's very different than a gubernatorial pardon, if I understand correctly. A gubernatorial pardon basically is like King's X, didn't happen. Is that correct? Governor says it didn't happen.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that's correct exactly either. I think that a pardon just says, okay, you did this, but you're pardoned. I don't think that sets it aside. I don't think that it creates another legal fiction that never happened.
Interesting. Okay, good. Well, that's not even part of the bill, but I threw it in there anyway. So, okay. We've got some criminal defense lawyers that would like to talk to us. Senator Purdy.
The last section 3 of this bill indicates that it applies to juvenile convictions as well. Could you does it treat juvenile convictions the same as adult convictions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the bill would actually amend both the adult statute, which is the setting aside statute, and the juvenile statute, which is actually literally an expunction statute. So it would make them track so that they have parallel provisions.
Okay, so to follow up, so a person crime committed by a 14-year-old would not be allowed to be expunged for that person's whole life?
That would be the result of this bill, yes.
Mm. Mr. Chair, I have concerns about that.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a good point, too, because I'm not sure that at the age of 14, that would almost send our juvenile judges back into the realm we don't want them to be engaged in, where they're moving things into a delinquency proceeding as opposed to a dependency as opposed to delinquency. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
So who is it here from the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is going to sacrifice themselves? By the way, for the committee, the Senate President has decided not to supply coffee to the committee, so we'll have to take occasional breaks to run to the Senate lounge to grab coffee, and the chair will be...
This is a permanent situation, Chairman.
From my understanding, it is.
I protested
yesterday, but it did not work. The Senate President had no mercy on me.
We'll have
nothing to go with.
Senate
starting.
Yeah.
This is not acceptable.
All right, Susan, so if you find us to be a bit testy, perhaps that's why.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we're here in opposition to Senate Bill 305. In our opinion, the bill unnecessarily eliminates judicial discretion. Under current law, a defendant may apply for expungement of a Class C felony, except for sex crimes and criminal mistreatment, where the criminal mistreatment constitutes child abuse. And a defendant may only do so after 3 years from the time of judgment and provided a number of other conditions are met, and I've outlined those in my written testimony. The defendant must show that he or she has fully complied and performed the sentence of the court, that he or she has not been convicted of any other offense for the past 10 years, that the defendant has not been arrested in the past 3 years, excluding motor vehicle violations, and that the defendant has no charges pending. The district attorney may object to the expungement, and the court must hold a hearing to determine whether, and this is the language of the statute, the circumstances and behavior of the defendant justify setting aside the conviction. The victim has an absolute right to be heard at the hearing. Where the defendant is seeking to expunge a Class C person felony, the court may deny this request where it finds by clear and convincing evidence that granting the expungement would not be, in the words, best interest of justice. That's a provision that only applies to a number of listed Class C person felonies. It does not apply, or is not a standard, in dealing with non-person Class C felonies. In determining this, the court may look at the facts and circumstances of the offense and not merely the defendant's subsequent behavior. Present in dealing with this provision in terms of the court determining whether it's in the best interest of justice, there are a number of Class C person felonies listed. In our opinion, let me rephrase that, not all Class C person felonies are listed because every session new crimes are made that become Class C person felonies. We would certainly think it would be appropriate that in subsection 11 of the expungement bill, that subsection 11 be modified so as to provide, rather than a list of current Class C person felonies, simply the language that is proposed by Senate Bill 305, which is a Class C felony that is classified as a person felony under the rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Senate Bill 305 would make all Class C person felonies ineligible for expungement, including juvenile records, regardless of these circumstances and forever after. In juvenile cases, it's important to remember that the juvenile is not entitled to a jury trial. And in many cases, the courts find jurisdiction in part in marginal cases, looking at the needs for services for the youth, and often do not hold, or it may be argued that they do not hold the state to quite as high a burden as may apply with a jury trial. A felony conviction affects numerous aspects of an individual's life, employment, education, and housing. To give but one example, a felony conviction makes a person ineligible for state financial aid to attend college. The court should continue to have the authority to determine whether expungement is in the best interest of justice based on the specific circumstances of the case. Expungement may encourage offender rehabilitation, reduce recidivism, provides a sort of a fresh start or a second chance for an individual who's been able to comply with these numerous requirements in terms of being crime-free, and has complied completely with the sentence of the court and has turned their life around. To give a couple examples of things that sort of are most commonly, I would say, Class C person felonies and the types of cases where expungement, I think, does and should happen. And remembering always that the court can determine that based on the fact of the case, that the courts will say, look, this case was so egregious or the facts were so exceptional, I will not expunge your conviction. But these are the types of cases where we think that the judges do and should be able to exercise discretion. I'll give an example. Someone attempting to hit someone with a skateboard but not actually hitting them during an argument would be an attempt at assault 3. Two people in an argument with one another person and hit that person, assault 3, say a bar fight.
But using an attempted assault 3 is an A misdemeanor, isn't it?
No, it's actually hitting.
Oh, okay.
It's assault 3. So two people in a bar fight with someone else and the two people.
I thought you used a skateboard thing where
attempted assault
3 is, I think, what you said.
Attempted assault 3 with a skateboard in that the argument would be with the skateboard. Could be used as a dangerous weapon.
That's kind of a stretch, don't you think? If somebody's going to whack somebody with a skateboard, you can argue it was attempted assault, too.
Mr. Chair, we see those kind of cases.
I couldn't get one of those things in the Multnomah County DA's office if I had to. They'd laugh me out of the office.
Oh, Mr. Chair, in my experience, I've seen cases where they have it's been charged matters such as skateboards, things like that have been charged as assault. And to get just a couple more examples. Using or threatening to use force after shoplifting, not actually using force, is a robbery, 3, and that's a fairly common crime where someone reacts, makes the mistake of shoplifting, and then makes the additional mistake of deciding to run and struggle to get away.
Is shoplifting a mistake?
Excuse me?
Shoplifting, is that a mistake?
It's a terrible mistake.
All right. And
finally, I give an example. In this kind of case, we have seen two kids, stealing a candy bar from another by threatening force. I've actually written down rob 2 here, but it's actually rob 3. That's a mistake. So those are all class C felonies.
Okay.
Class C assaults can also come into this category, and what we often see is it's cases where somebody is acting in self-defense but overreacts, meaning they use excessive force or they just respond. They have a legitimate self-defense issue, but they just go too far. We have cases that involve battered women syndrome. And to give but one example of a case that's been handled by our office where someone qualified for expungement based on her record and actually was, her conviction was expunged. It was for an assault 3. She was a woman with a long history of being of domestic violence and being abused. She had assaulted, and the issue was that she had over-responded with self-defense and was charged, convicted of assault 3. I believe she'd gone to school and gotten divorced and remarried, begun a new family, and had a job as a security officer. And she was in excellent employment. There were numerous letters from her employer saying what a great job she had done and that they were willing to keep her on provided that she was able to remove the felony conviction from her record. And she was, based on sort of the overwhelming evidence in terms of the extenuating circumstances of her original conviction and the excellent things she had done to sort of turn her life around and move forward. So there are circumstances in which class C person felonies should and ought to be expunged, and the standards are high, and the court considers this matter very seriously.
All right. Now, you said something that wasn't in your testimony, I thought, at least with respect to the rule issue and the language in the bill, and I wasn't sure. Were you supporting the deletion of the delineation of various crimes and supporting amended language that would allow those to be included by rule by the
Mr. Chair, correct. I think that's a completely reasonable proposal. What I anticipate happens is that, every session we simply add another, crime that becomes a Class C person felony. So, for example, assaulting a public safety officer is not included because it became a Class C person felony last session. So I think rather than simply adding all the time, if we just use the proposed language in Section 5 and put that in Section 11, that would be an appropriate
amendment. How would you feel if we change the clear and convincing evidence standard to preponderance of the evidence?
And Mr. Chair, I think that's also
It's downgrading the level of proof needed.
Mr. Chair, correct. And I think that's also a better proposal than
than just outright.
Correct. I think in the cases, Mr. Chair, where the courts are exercising their discretion, I think they are taking this very seriously. So I think that
clear and convincing evidence is a fairly high standard.
Correct.
So, okay, good. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Brady.
Just to pursue that point, that the clear and convincing evidence, I read that to that if they complied with the four requirements for expungement, that the court, the burden of proof is on the district attorney to show that there's clear and convincing evidence that they shouldn't be expunged. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, correct, because of the word not, would not be in the best interest, I suppose. Yes.
Right, and that can go back to the nature of the crime. Particularly heinous crimes could be used to meet that standard, declaring convincing evidence.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's correct, and the courts, and I'm aware of cases where the courts have specifically ruled on that the defendant has certainly made great improvements and complied with the preliminary requirements, but that the crime is such that the court is unwilling under any circumstances to remove it from his or her record.
But you'd be comfortable with a preponderance of the evidence standards, is what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berg, I think that that's a legitimate approach to this issue.
Okay. And what about an extension of the time period? You've got no more convictions for the past 10 years, but for example, what if you extended the time for arrest, maybe from 3 to 5 years? I mean, how would you feel about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burke, I think that all of those kind of things in terms of actually working with numbers, I think, are fair and a better approach than simply putting a complete bar. I can tell you that we do, in the Public Defender's Office where I was at, we handle a huge amount of expungements, and when you actually look at all these qualifications, I think it is a pretty high standard, but I certainly think that looking at those kind of matters. For example, we're talking about arrest. It's not only arrest that actually results in a crime, but if you are, if a defendant is actually arrested, or a defendant is arrested for anything other than a traffic, citation, that will be a bar, even if it's determined that there was no criminal behavior. So really it's saying no police contact that goes beyond sort of a conversation, anything where someone is arrested or there's sort of a level of suspicion would bar them. So I certainly think that those matters can be looked at when we're talking about that person felonies. But I guess I would say to the committee that I think that those numbers actually do work, and they are a pretty high standard between complying with all the terms of the judgment, which would be paying restitution and counseling and treatment or whatever else was ordered, and having no sort of police conduct that would result in arrest for 3 years, and then not having a conviction for the prior 10 years. It's really quite of a multiple facet.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming that expungement is not available for AMD felonies?
Under no circumstances, that's correct.
I did some research last session into the whole expungement thing. There's some process involving magistrates that you can get a conviction wiped off. Is that sound familiar? There's another alternative process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burke, not to my knowledge, I mean, committee counsel might have a different recollection, but my understanding is that under no circumstances can class A or B felonies or sex offenses or criminal mistreatment where it involves child neglect. It's just a complete bar in those circumstances. So,
thank you.
I'm just. It looks to me like this was part of the criminal law revision in, like, 1972. There's a few references to 1971, 72 in here. I'm just wondering if we know what the logic or rationale was for not allowing the expungement of a B or A felony that was not the person.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the exact answer, but I simply think that there was I'm assuming there was a sense that those were sufficiently aggravated that they should not be considered.
Okay.
I don't know.
Do we have any idea, does anybody have an idea how many proceedings like this we have or how many applications for expungement there might be on a yearly basis?
Mr. Chair, for Class C person felonies or for...
For any of these expungement requests.
I would think there are a fair amount. I put a fair amount. I could try. What I'll do is I can try to see if we can get some numbers on how many there are. But and of course we have a lot of misdemeanors. For example, expungement statute also applies to arrests where someone is arrested and never prosecuted. So when we're talking about arrests, I think there's a fair amount. I know that it was the statute was modified to provide that there is a financial requirement now for expungement, so that the petitioner bears some of the expense in terms
of
costs.
Yeah, with respect to that issue, there's an $80 charge that's paid to the Department of State Police, I assume, for doing a background check or whatever they do. And I'd like to put on the record, I'd like to find out from the State Police whether that charge is adequate to cover their expenses now. So, because this may be an opportunity to charge more to cover the expenses. All right? Any other comments?
Nothing further, and I will do my best, Ms. Chair, to see if I can try to get some numbers to the committee about how many of these arrests and convictions we're talking about.
All right, Susan, thank you. I think your testimony is helpful. Carl Myers.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, for your record, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. The association's legislative committee is meeting this afternoon to discuss this bill and take a formal position, but I've been asked to appear in front of you today to indicate our concerns to Senate Bill 305 as it relates to juvenile convictions for all the reasons that Ms. Russell and other witnesses have stated. It is a concern to the juvenile department directors that that avenue would not be available to juveniles who would otherwise qualify and benefit from having their juvenile record expunged in these cases. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to respond to any detailed questions about that because I've not been fully briefed on how it would apply, but I'll try to attempt to respond if there are any questions.
All right. Carl, thank you very much, and you'll get back with us.
I will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions, concerns, political diatribes? None? Close public hearing on Senate Bill 305, and I think we'll try to work with the parties to see if we can come up with something that might work. Okay. I'm going to take about a 10-minute break, and we'll get a cup of coffee, and... we'll be back. We're in recess.
No relation.
No relation. Okay.
Good morning again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Alfred French on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Senate Bill 306 is one of the bills that was introduced at the request of our association. It's a very simple bill. It would change the culpable mental state that the prosecution is required to prove in failure to appear cases from intentional to knowingly. Historically, before 1973, Oregon relied on bail bondsmen to ensure presence of people in court, and when the Criminal Procedure Code was rewritten in 1973 to
legislature made the judgment to do away with bail bondsmen and to rely on the prosecution of people who don't properly appear in court for failure to appear. Essentially, that system has pretty much broken down. And part of the reason, there are many causes, not all of them addressed by this bill, but part of the reason is the difficulty and, in a lot of cases, impossibility of the district attorney to prove the culpable mental state required for failure to appear. Essentially, we have to prove that the defendant did not show up in court on purpose at the time he was supposed to be there. So if a defendant goes on a bender the night before, doesn't set his alarm clock, doesn't get up, doesn't go to court, he's not guilty of failure to appear. If he gets up in the morning, makes himself a cup of coffee, has some breakfast, and says to himself, I'm not going to go to court this morning, then he is guilty. As a practical matter, the big problem that prosecutors face is that the evidence that we have in failure to appear cases is that the defendant appeared in court on the underlying charge, was released on some kind of a release agreement, either a security release agreement or personal recognizance, and was told to come to court, usually in writing. Most courts require the defendant to sign some kind of a notice. And then he didn't show up. And eventually, when he doesn't show up, the court issues a warrant for his arrest, and eventually he is arrested on the warrant and he comes back to court. But there is no information available to this attorney as to why he didn't come to court. So proving a culpable mental state is always has to be done by circumstantial evidence, and if that's all you have, then in most cases they're just not provable.
Right. Any questions?
Makes sense to me, but we'll hear from the criminal defense lawyers here. They'll throw a few cogs in the wheel. So, Susan, are you up again?
Thank you.
Susan, when you're ready.
Okay. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, here in opposition of Senate Bill 306. In our opinion, Senate Bill 306 lowers the required mental state for failure to appear from intentionally and knowingly, and that this lowered mental state is unnecessary and can lead to some complications and problems that we foresee. I set out the definition of both intentionally and knowingly in my written testimony. And in summary, really, intentionally is someone acting with a conscious objective, whereas knowingly is really where the person acts with awareness. By lowering the mental element, Senate Bill 306 will expand the scope of failure to appear. And I think failure to appear is a bit more complex and expansive than someone often making a conscious decision or simply saying, I'm not going to set my alarm in advance and not show up. It can encompass people potentially under this lower knowingly mental state who are incapable of making it to court, where presently it would not. Somebody who has a medical emergency or a medical situation. Someone who is incarcerated, and it's surprising the number of cases in which a failure to appear defense is presented, that the defendant was actually in custody, sometimes in custody in the same courthouse where the court is issuing a failure to appear. It can be that the defendant is out of custody on a pending charge and is arrested on a new charge and is actually upstairs and nobody is aware of it, and a warrant is issued. By lowering the mental state to knowingly, it can include people who are mistaken or confused about court dates. An average case does not have sort of a clear line in terms of court dates. There's an initial arraignment, and in between the arraignment and the eventual resolution, either through clear trial, there can be numerous court dates, and court dates can be changed with very little notice. Sometimes court dates can be requested, a set over can be requested without a defendant actually being present. Often, a defense attorney will rely on communicating with the defendant through post, and addresses may change when we're talking about short time frames of case being accelerated or set over. With increased budget constraints, I think it's fair to anticipate that there may be more court dates before a case is resolved, and that the setovers may be longer. At present, there are already jurisdictions where it takes a good year for the sort of lesser cases to come to trial, where people are out of custody, and it can have multiple. The case can have multiple court appearances in the interim. If a defendant fails to appear at present, a warrant is issued for his arrest, and if the defendant has posted bail, the bail is forfeited. So there are additional matters that are there to ensure a defendant make it to court. In our opinion, the intentional mental state is appropriate given the numbers of complexities that can arise in a criminal case, in the proceeding of a criminal case. I'll give an example. I was once a witness in a failure to appear prosecution in which the case had proceeded as I was a defense counsel, and it was a motion to suppress. And the defendant lost the motion to suppress, and the day concluded with people discussing openly in front of him, including myself and the court and the district attorney, that this would be appealed. The defendant left the courtroom. His case was still pending, and we were already there the next morning for trial. He wasn't there because he believed the case was going to be appealed. Did he have an awareness that the case was continuing? Did he have a conscious objective to fail to appear? The court found that he did not have a conscious objective.
Was this one of your clients?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
So maybe we should have thrown you in jail. I mean, isn't it your responsibility as an attorney to clearly state what the defendant's responsibilities are to your client?
And Mr. Chair, and I guess what I'm trying to explain is that we often think we do that. And we know as attorneys that a motion to suppress follows a trial, and the trial goes, and in advance we've talked to our clients. But sometimes things seem so obvious to us, and when we handle so many hundreds and hundreds of cases, that problems happen.
I know, but I dealt with many of these morons. I mean, come on. These people know full well what their responsibilities are. You know that. Now, it's just out of curiosity, what do these people tell you, without naming names, what do they tell you when they don't show up for court? Because, I mean, you obviously stood in court before, and the defendant's nowhere to be found, and you ultimately talked to them later. What do they say?
Mr. Chair, I would say there's two categories. One category that fails to appear, and is that group can be and is often prosecuted for failure to appear. And there's another group that doesn't either get it in general or more specifically is confused about court dates. And there are so many players and some of these cases are moving so quickly. I mean, we have cases where the courts are giving us wrong dates or you can have the district attorney, the defense attorney, and the court may all have a confusion as to what's going on. So there is a legitimate category of cases where for perhaps no one's fault or the fault of many.
Right.
It's very confusing.
Okay. Senator Burnett.
It would seem to me, though, in a case like that where there's confusion about the court dates, that the knowingly standard would get wrong. I mean, if they didn't know they were supposed to be in court, then they would not, they would meet the standard.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burke, in some of those cases, yes, that would be. But I believe that there are other cases where someone is confused or mistaken.
But if they're confused or mistaken, then they don't know. I mean, if their lawyer tells them, which it seems reasonable that a lawyer should tell their client when they're supposed to be in court, then they would know. And if they didn't show up, then they would fall under this. But if the lawyer didn't think to tell them, then I would say they didn't know.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, I certainly think when a lawyer gives a client the wrong date or the court or there's some confusion like that where the then I think that whatever the mental state, I think the defendant would have a good defense. But there are cases, for example, what happens a lot in these cases is that a defendant may sign a release agreement when being released from custody, and the court dates are set down there. And then the defendant believes that the court dates are changed or that his or her appearance is changed. I mean, there may be something legitimate going on, or there is an emergency, a medical emergency, where the defendant believes that his or her attendance isn't required, or that there is a different date. In those kind of cases, I think the awareness would be, the argument would be that the awareness was established from the defendant but signing an original release agreement.
Susan, help me understand this, because my familiarity with the criminal justice system is such that if a person was arrested on a warrant for this, the court's going to be pretty lenient in setting another date and giving the person another chance before they proceed to a subsequent criminal prosecution for fail to appear. I mean, these are pretty extreme cases for the most part that ultimately are prosecuted.
And Mr. Chair, members, I think it depends on the county. In Multnomah County, where I practice for the most part, I don't think I ever, other than being the witness in that one unusual case, I don't think I ever handled a failure to appear, and I think we see very few.
Right.
They tend to be an actual failure to appear at the day of trial where there's no question but the defendant made a conscious, objective decision not to go.
Right.
Other counties is different. I practiced for almost 2 years then in Washington County, and failure to appear are a very prevalent charge.
So I've always thought we ought to go back to the bail bondsman thing. In fact, in previous sessions, I think I introduced legislation to do that, because I think it's far better to have Guido go follow him around, drag the raggedy hind end back into the jail system, because they can get away with a lot more than the cops can.
And Mr. Chair, I don't think this is going to answer the problem of failures to appear.
I know, but you know what? It's like they disrespect the court system. They disrespect law enforcement. They disrespect the judicial process. They disregard the edicts of their government. And, you know, someone who fails to appear because they forgot the court date or something, I can't see a judge or even a jury, if the person's legitimate, convicting that person. But if you've got somebody who's just a pain in the backside, who doesn't show up, and I'm assuming repeatedly, then when you capture them, you ought to be able to throw another charge. I think this is my opinion. I tend to be a little bit law enforcement siding of it.
Mr. Chair, our position is simply that is the law at present, and that does happen.
But see, your job as a defense attorney is not to babysit these people, is it? Sometimes it seems like defense attorneys, you guys get kind of screwed over in the process, too, because the defendant doesn't show up, and then you've got to come up with some story to the judge to say, hey,
well,
I have no idea where my client's at.
You know, Mr. Chair, you have to remember that at this point we represent an adult court. Juveniles are automatically, you know, placed in under charges and may be released on Measure 11 charges, and we represent a lot of clients that are either substance and often mentally impaired. So we're often talking about a group that obviously isn't functioning well in society, is getting themselves through the criminal justice system, and often getting them through the criminal justice system is an effort on everyone's behalf. And I think when we talk in the abstract, it's hard to remember that there are some very compelling and sympathetic people that get themselves in a situation for whom no one is really there looking after them, and we're all courts, district attorneys and defense attorneys, probation officers and police force are in a role of really caretaking for these people. Those are the people we are most concerned about being impacted poorly.
Yeah, I guess. I just, as a practitioner in that area of arresting people and putting them in jail and prison, I just see a lot more compassion than maybe is perceived by the public on the part of the criminal justice system and particularly law enforcement. I mean, we actually let a lot of people slide on stuff until it gets to the point where it's intolerable, and then we throw them in jail or whatnot. So, you know, it's my perception, and I've got kind of one little bend on it. So I kind of like the bill. So, I don't want to commit anything. Senator Starr, where might you be? Senator Walker, where might you be?
Well, I just have a question.
Sure.
Thank you.
Were you over there nudging?
No.
Okay.
Kind of like took some medication, so I'm not quite here. Ms. Russell, I've toured some of the courts in my lifetime, and one of the things that they always complain about is they have a lot of failure to appear. I remember when we took a tour of Marion County Court last session, that was one of the things that they talked about. Would changing this mental state from intentionally to knowingly, would that reduce the number of failure to appears?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, in my opinion, it would not. It's simply a matter of, this would only affect the proof issue when these cases, when a decision is actually made to prosecute for a failure to appear. I don't think by changing a mental state from awareness to conscious objective that that's going to have an impact on a body of people who make a decision to appear in court or not to appear in court. You'd have to, would have to assume that they were very clairvoyant or very knowledgeable in the law for such a such a matter that would even understand for them to affect their behavior. So I think if the problem is trying to get people to come to court, I don't think this is going to I don't think this is going to affect that, and I don't even think it's being proposed as a remedy for that problem.
Well, my comment is that I think people should know their court dates, and I appreciate your conversation about confusion and that sort of thing, but that's used a lot as an excuse to just intentionally not go. And I know when you're dealing with people who don't have transportation, that becomes an issue, trying to get to court on time and transportation issues, but I don't see this as a big deal.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to have a little work session on Senate Bill 306.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move to adopt Senate Bill 306 and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 306 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on Senator Burdick's motion? There's none. Any opposition to the motion? There's none. The motion passes. Senator Walker, can you just carry this over?
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay. Senator Walker will carry the bill. And any other business before the committee? There is none. Thank you very much for your patience this morning with the absence of coffee, et cetera.
Not giving up, Mr. Chair.